The Sultan turns and leaves the room to a dignified ovation. Those are the ground rules, boys. Now run along and play. Dr. Mohammed Pragasu, Kinakutan Minister of Information, now rises from his chair, which is to the right hand of the Sultan's throne, naturally, and takes the con. His accent is almost as American as the Sultan's is British. He did his undergrad work at Berkeley and got his doctorate at Stanford. Randy knows several people who worked and studied with him during those years. According to them, Pragasu rarely showed up for work in anything other than a t-shirt and jeans, and showed just as strong an appetite for beer and sausage pizza as any non-Mohammedan. No one had a clue that he was a Sultan's second cousin, and worth a few hundred million in his own right. But that was 10 years ago. More recently, in his dealings with Epiphyte Corp., he's been better dressed, better behaved, but studiously informal. First names only, please. Dr. Pragasu likes to be addressed as Prag. All of their meetings have started with an uninhibited exchange of the latest jokes. Then Prag inquires about his old school buddies, most of whom are working in Silicon Valley now. He delves for tips on the latest and hottest high-tech stocks, reminisces for a few minutes about the wild times he enjoyed back in California, and then gets down to business. None of them has ever seen Prague in his true element until now. It's a bit hard to keep a straight face, as if some old school chum of theirs had rented a suit, forged an ID card, and was now staging a prank at a stuffy business meeting. But there is a solemnity about Dr. Pragasu's bearing today that is impressive, verging on oppressive. Those Chinese guys across the table look like the Maoist Mount Rushmore. It is impossible to imagine that any of them has ever smiled in his life. They are getting a live translation of the proceedings through earpieces, connected through the mysterious table to a boiler room full of interpreters. Randy's attention wanders. Prague's talk is dull because it is covering technical ground, with which Randy is already painfully familiar, couched in simple analogies, designed to make some kind of sense even after being translated with Mandarin, Cantonese, Nipponese, or what have you. Randy begins looking around the table. There is a delegation of Filipinos. One of them, a fat man in his 50s, looks awfully familiar. As usual, Randy cannot remember his name. And there's another guy who shows up late all by himself and is ushered to a solitary chair down at the far end. He might be a Filipino with lots of Spanish blood, but he's more likely Latin American or Southern European, or just an American whose forebears came from those places. In any case, he has scarcely settled into his seat before he's pulled out a cell phone and punched in a very long phone number and begun a hushed, tense conversation. He keeps sneaking glances up the table, checking out each delegation in turn, then blurting capsule descriptions into his cell phone. He seems startled to be here. No one who sees him can avoid noticing his furtiveness. No one who notices it can avoid speculating on how he acquired it. But at the same time, the man has a sullen, glowering air about him that Randy doesn't notice until his black eyes turn to stare into Randy's like the twin barrels of a derringer. Randy stares back, too startled and stupid to avert his gaze, and some kind of strange information passes from the cell phone man to him, down the twin shafts of black light coming out of the man's eyes. Randy realizes that he and the rest of Epiphyte II Corp. have fallen in among thieves. Skipping. It's a hot, cloudy day in the Bismarck Sea when Goto Dengo loses the war. The American bombers come in low and level. Goto Dengo happens to be above decks on a fresh air and calisthenics drill. To breathe air that does not smell of shit and vomit makes him feel euphoric and invulnerable. Everyone else must be feeling the same way, because he watches the airplanes for a long time before he begins to hear warning klaxons. The Emperor's soldiers are supposed to feel euphoric and invulnerable all the time, because their indomitable spirit makes them so. That Goto Dengo only feels that way when above decks, breathing clean air, makes him ashamed. The other soldiers never doubt, or at least never show it. He wonders where he went astray. Perhaps it was his time in Shanghai where he was polluted with foreign ideas. Or maybe he was polluted from the very beginning. The ancient family curse. The troop transports are slow. There is no pretense that they are anything other than boxes of air. They have only the most pathetic armaments. The destroyers escorting them are sounding general quarters. Goto Dango stands at the rail and watches the crews of the destroyers scrambling to their positions. Black smoke and blue light sputter from the barrels of their weapons, and much later he hears them opening fire. The American bombers must be in some kind of distress. He speculates that they are low on fuel or desperately lost, or have been chased down below the cloud cover by Zeros. Whatever the reason, he knows they have not come here to attack the convoy because American bombers attack by flying overhead at a great altitude, raining down bombs. The bombs always miss because the Americans' bomb sites are so poor and the crews so inept. No, the arrival of American planes here is just one of those bizarre accidents of war. The convoy has been shielded under heavy clouds since early yesterday. The troops all around Goto Dango are cheering. What good fortune that these lost Americans have blundered straight into the gun sights of their destroyer escort. And it is a good omen for the village of Kulu, too, because half of the town's young men just happen to be above decks to enjoy the spectacle. They grew up together, went to school together, at the age of 20 took the military physical together, joined the army together, and trained together. Now they are on their way to New Guinea together. Together they were mustered up onto the deck of the transport only 5 minutes ago. Together they will enjoy the sight of the American planes softening into cartwheels of flame. Goto Dango, at 26, is one of the old hands here. He came back from Shanghai to be a leader and an example to them. And he watches their faces. These faces he has known since he was a child. Never happier than at this moment, glowing like cherry petals in the gray world of cloud, ocean, and painted steel. Fresh delight ripples across their faces. He turns to look. One of the bombers has apparently decided to lighten its load by dropping a bomb straight into the ocean. The boys of Kulu break into a jeering chant. The American plane, having shed half a ton of useless explosives, peels sharply upward, self-neutered, good for nothing but target practice. The Kulu boys howl at its pilot in contempt. A Nipponese pilot would have crashed his plane into that destroyer at the very least. Goto Dango, for some reason, watches the bomb instead of the airplane. It does not tumble from the plane's belly, but traces a smooth, flat parabola above the waves, like an aerial torpedo. He catches his breath for a moment, afraid that it will never drop into the ocean, that it will skim across the water until it hits the destroyer that stands directly across its path. But once again, the fortunes of war smile upon the Emperor's forces. The bomb loses its struggle with gravity and splashes into the water. Goto Dango looks away. Then he looks back again, chasing a phantom that haunts the edge of his vision. The wings of foam that were thrown up by the bomb are still collapsing into the water, but beyond them, a black moat is speeding away. Perhaps it was a second bomb dropped by the same airplane. This time, Goto Dango watches it carefully. It seems to be rising rather than falling. A mirage, perhaps. No, he's wrong. It is losing altitude slowly now, and it plows into the water and throws up another pair of wings, all right. And then the bomb rises up out of the water again. Goto Dango, a student of engineering, implores the laws of physics to take hold of this thing and make it fall and sink, which is what big, dumb pieces of metal are supposed to do. Eventually, it does fall again, but then it rises up again. It is skipping across the water like the flat rocks that the boys of Kulu used to throw across the fish pond near the village. Goto Dango watches it skip several more times, utterly fascinated. Once again, the fortunes of war have provided a bizarre spectacle, seemingly for no other reason than to entertain him. He savors it, as if it were a cigarette discovered in the bottom of a pocket. Skip, skip, skip. Right into the flank of one of the escorting destroyers. A gun turret flies straight up into the air, tumbling over and over. Just as it slows to its apogee, it is completely enveloped in a geyser of flame spurting out of the ship's engine room. The Kulu boys are still chanting, refusing to accept the evidence of their own eyes. Something flashes in Goto Dango's peripheral vision. He turns to watch another destroyer being snapped in half like a dry twig as its magazines detonate. Tiny black things are skip, skip, skipping all over the ocean now, like fleas across the rumpled bedsheets of a Shanghai whorehouse. The chant falters. Everyone watches silently. The Americans have invented a totally new bombing tactic in the middle of a war and implemented it flawlessly. His mind staggers like a drunk in the aisle of a careening train. They saw that they were wrong. They admitted their mistake. They came up with a new idea. The new idea was accepted and embraced all the way up the chain of command. Now they are using it to kill their enemies. No warrior with any concept of honor would have been so craven, so flexible. What a loss of face it must have been for the officers who had trained their men to bomb from high altitudes. What has become of those men? They must have all killed themselves, or perhaps been thrown into prison. The American Marines in Shanghai weren't proper warriors either, constantly changing their ways. Like Shafto. Shafto tried to fight Nipponese soldiers in the street and failed. Having failed, he decided to learn new tactics from Goto Dango. The Americans are not warriors, everyone kept saying. Businessmen, perhaps, not warriors. Below decks, the soldiers are cheering and chanting. They have not the faintest idea what is really going on. For just a moment, Goto Dango tears his eyes away from the sea full of exploding and sinking destroyers. He gets a bearing on a locker full of life preservers. The airplanes all seem to be gone now. He scans the convoy and finds no destroyers in working order.
"Put on the life jackets!" he shouts.
None of the men seem to hear him, and so he makes for the locker.
"Hey, put on the life jackets!"
He pulls one out and holds it up, in case they can't hear him. They can hear him just fine. They look at him as if what he's doing is more shocking than anything they have witnessed in the last 5 minutes. What possible use are life jackets?
"Just in case," he shouts, "so we can fight for the Emperor another day."
He says this last part weakly. One of the men, a boy who lived a few doors away from him when they were children, walks up to him, tears the life jacket out of his hands, and throws it into the ocean. He looks Goto up and down, contemptuously, then turns around and walks away. Another man shouts and points. "The second wave of planes is coming in." Goto Dango goes to the rail to stand among his comrades, but they sidle away. The American planes charge in unopposed and veer away, leaving behind nothing but more skipping bombs. Goto Dango watches a bomb come directly toward him for a few bounces until he can make out the message painted on its nose, "Bend over Tojo."
"This way!"
he shouts. He turns his back to the bomb and walks back across the deck to the locker full of life preservers. This time a few of the men follow him. The ones who don't, perhaps 5% of the population of the village of Kulu, are catapulted into the ocean when the bomb explodes beneath their feet. The wooden deck buckles upwards. One of the Kulu boys falls with a 4-foot-long splinter driven straight up through his viscera. Goto Dango and perhaps a dozen others make it to the locker on hands and knees and grab life preservers. He would not be doing this if he had not already lost the war in his soul. A warrior would stand his ground and die. His men are only following him because he has told them to do it. 2 more bombs burst while they are getting the life preservers on and struggling to the rail. Most of the men below must be dead now. Goto Dengo nearly doesn't make it to the railing because it is rising sharply into the air. He ends up doing a chin-up on it and throwing one leg over the side, which is now nearly horizontal. The ship is rolling over. Four others get a grip on the rail. The rest slide helplessly down the deck and vanish into a pit of smoke. Goto Dengo ignores what his eyes are telling him and tries to listen to his inner ear. He is standing up on the side of the ship now, and, looking toward the stern, he can see one of the propellers spinning uselessly in the air. He begins running uphill. The four others follow him. An American fighter plane comes over. He doesn't even realize they are being strafed until he turns around and sees that the bullets have essentially cut one man in half and crippled another by exploding his knee, so that the lower leg and foot dangle by a few shreds of gristle. Goto Dengo throws the man over his shoulders like a sack of rice and turns to resume the uphill race, but finds that there is no more uphill to race towards. He and the other two are standing on the summit of the ship now, a steel bulge that rises for no more than a man's height out of the water. He turns around once, then twice, looking for a place to run, and sees nothing but water all around. The water bloops and fizzes angrily as air and smoke jet from the interior of the wrecked hull. Sea rushes in towards them. Goto Dengo looks down at the steel bubble supporting his feet and realizes that he is still, just for a moment, perfectly dry. Then the Bismarck Sea converges on his feet from all directions at once and begins to climb up his legs. A moment later, the steel plate, which has been pressing so solidly against the soles of his boots, drops away. The weight of the wounded man on his shoulders shoves him straight down into the ocean. He gulps fuel oil into his sinuses, struggles out from beneath the wounded man, and comes to the surface screaming. His nose and the cavities of his skull are filled with oil. He swallows some of it and goes into convulsions as his body tries to eject it from every orifice at once, sneezing, vomiting, hawking it up out of his lungs. Reaching up to his face with one hand, he feels the oil coating his skin thickly and knows that he dare not open his eyes. He tries to wipe the oil from his face with his sleeve, but the fabric is saturated with it. He has to get down in the water and wipe himself clean so that he can see again, but the oil in his clothing make him float. His lungs are finally clear now, and he begins to gasp in air. It smells of oil, but at least it's breathable. But the volatile chemicals in the oil have gotten into his blood now, and he feels them spread through his body like fire. It feels as though a hot spatula is being shoved between his scalp and his skull. The other men are howling, and he realizes that he is too. Some of the Chinese workers in Shanghai used to breathe gasoline to get high, and this was the noise that they made. One of the men near him screams. He hears a noise approaching, like a sheet being torn in half to make bandages. Radiant heat strikes him in the face like a hot frying pan, just before Goto Dengo dives and kicks downwards. The motion exposes a band of flesh around his calf, between his boot and his trouser leg, and in the moment that it's poking straight up out of the water, it gets seared to a crisp. He swims blind through an ocean of fuel oil. Then there is a change in the temperature and the viscosity of the fluid streaming over his face. Suddenly, the life preserver begins to tug him upwards. He must be in water now. He swims for a few more clicks and begins to wipe at his eyes. The pressure on his ears tells him he's not that deep, maybe a couple of meters beneath the surface. Finally, he risks opening his eyes. Ghostly, flickering light is illuminating his hands, making them glow a bright green. The sun must have come out. He rolls over on his back and looks straight up. Above him is a lake of rolling fire. He rips the life preserver off over his head and lets it go. It shoots straight up and bursts out of the surface, burning like a comet. His oil-soaked clothing is tugging him relentlessly upwards, so he rips his shirt off and lets it tumble up towards the surface. His boots pull down, his oily pants push up, and he reaches some sort of equilibrium. He grew up in the mines. Kulu is near the north coast of Hokkaido, on the shore of a freshwater lake where rivers converge from the inland hills and commingle their waters before draining to the Sea of Okhotsk. The hills rise sharply from one end of that lake, looming over a cold silver creek that rushes down out of forest inhabited only by apes and demons. There are small islands in that part of the lake. If you dig down into the islands, or the hills, you will find veins of copper ore, or sometimes you will find zinc and lead, and even silver. That is what the men of Kulu have done for many generations. Their monument is a maze of tunnels that snake through the hills, not following straight lines, but tracking the richest veins. Sometimes the tunnels dip below the level of the lake. When the mines were working, these tunnels were pumped out. But now that they are exhausted, the water has been allowed to seek its level and has formed sumps. There are cavities and tunnels back in the hills that can only be reached by boys who are brave enough to dive into the cold black water and swim through the darkness for 10, 20, 30 meters. Godo Dengo went to all of those places when he was a boy. He even discovered some of them. Big, fat, and buoyant, he was a pretty good swimmer. He was not the best swimmer, or the best at holding his breath. He was not even the bravest. The bravest did not put on life preservers and went to their deaths like warriors. He went where the others wouldn't because he, alone among all the boys of Kulu, was not afraid of the demons. When he was a boy, his father, a mining engineer, would take him hiking up into the places in the mountains where demons were said to live. They would sleep out under the stars and wake up to find their blankets covered with frost and sometimes their food stolen by bears, but no demons. The other boys believed that demons lived in some of those underwater tunnels, and that this explained why some of the boys who swam back there never returned. But Godo Dengo did not fear the demons, and so he went back there fearing only the cold and the dark and the water, which was plenty to fear. Now he need only pretend that the fire is a stone ceiling. He swims some more. But he did not breathe properly before diving, and he is close to panic now. He looks up again and sees that the water is burning only in patches. He is quite deep, he realizes, and he can't swim well in trousers and boots. He fumbles at his bootlaces, but they are tied in double knots. He pulls a knife from his belt and slashes through the laces, kicks the boots off, sheds his pants and drawers too. Naked, he forces himself to be calm for 10 more seconds, brings his knees to his chest and hugs them. His body's natural buoyancy takes over. He knows that he must be rising slowly toward the surface now, like a bubble. The light is growing brighter. He need only wait. He lets go of the knife, which is only slowing him down. His back feels cold. He explodes out of the fetal position and thrusts his head up into the air, gasping for breath. A patch of burning oil is almost close enough for him to touch, and the oil is trickling across the top of the ocean as if it were a solid surface. Nearly invisible blue flames seep from it, then turn yellow and boil off curling black smoke. He backstrokes away from a reaching tendril. A glowing silver apparition passes over him. So close, he can feel the warmth of its exhaust and read the English warning labels on its belly. The tips of its wing guns are sparkling, flinging out red streaks. They are strafing the survivors. Some try to dive, but the oil in their uniform pops them right back to the surface, legs flailing uselessly in the air. Godo Dengo first makes sure he is nowhere near any burning oil, then treads water, spinning slowly in the water like a radar dish, looking for planes. A P-38 comes in low, gunning for him. He sucks in a breath and dives. It is nice and quiet under the water, and the bullets striking its surface sound like the ticking of a big sewing machine. He sees a few rounds plunging into the water around him, leaving trails of bubbles as the water cavitates in their wake, slowing virtually to a stop in just a meter or two, then turning downwards and sinking like bombs. He swims after one and plucks it out of the water. It is still hot from its passage. He would keep it as a souvenir, but his pockets are gone with his clothes and he needs his hands. He stares at the bullet for a moment, greenish silver in the underwater light, fresh from some factory in America. How did this bullet come from America to my hand? We have lost. The war is over. I must go home and tell everyone. I must be like my father, a rational man, explaining the facts of the world to the people at home who are crippled by superstitions. He lets the bullet go again, watches it drop towards the bottom of the sea, where the ships and all of the young men of Kulu are bound. Mugs.
Hey, it's an immature market.
The rationalizations have not actually begun yet. Randy's still sitting in the Sultan's big conference room, and the meeting's just getting up to speed.
Naturally, the early adopters are not going to be your regular Joes.
Tom Howard has taken the floor to explain his work. Randy doesn't have much to do, so he's imagining tonight's conversation in the bomb and grapnel.
It's like the Wild West. A little unruly at first, then in a few years it settles down and you've got Fresno.
Most of the delegations have brought hired guns, engineers and security experts who'll get a bounty if they can find a flaw in Tom's system. One by one, these guys stand up to take their shots.
10 years from now, widows and paperboys will be banking in cyberspace.
Magnificent isn't the word you would normally use to describe Tom Howard. He's burly and surly, completely lacking in social graces, and doesn't apologize for it. Most of the time he sits silently wearing an expression of sphinx-like boredom, and so it's easy to forget how good he is. But during this particular half hour of Tom Howard's life, it is of the essence that he be magnificent. He is going blade to blade with the seven samurai here. The nerdiest high-octane PhDs and the scariest private security dicks that Asia can produce. One by one they come after him, and he cuts their heads off and stacks them on the table like cannonballs. Several times he has to stop and think for 60 seconds before delivering the death blow. Once he has to ask Eberhard Fuhr to make some calculations on his laptop. Occasionally he has to call on the cryptographic expertise of John Cantrell or to look over at Randy for a nod or shake of the head. But eventually he shuts the hecklers up. Beryl wears a not very convincing smile throughout the entire thing. Avi just grips the arms of his chair, his knuckles going from blue to white to pink to a normal healthy glow over the course of the final 5 minutes, when it's clear that the samurai are withdrawing in disarray. It makes Randy want to empty a six-shooter into the ceiling and holler, "Yee-haw!" at the top of his lungs. Instead, he listens, just in case Tom gets tripped up in the briar patch of plesiosynchronous protocol arcana, whence only Randy can drag him out. This gives him some more time to survey the faces of the other people in the room. But the meeting is a couple of hours old now, and they are all as familiar to him as siblings. Tom wipes his sword on his pant leg and thwacks his big ass resoundingly into his leather chair. Minions scurry into the room bringing tea and coffee and sugar-fat pods. Dr. Pragasu stands up and introduces John Cantrell.
Sheesh. So far the agenda is revolving entirely around Epiphyte Corp. What gives?
Dr. Pragasu, having developed a friendly relationship with these California hackers, is pimping them to his big money contacts.
That's what gives.
This is very interesting from a business standpoint. But Randy finds it a bit irksome and threatening, this one-way flow of information. By the time they go home, this assemblage of shady gamokes is going to know everything about Epiphyte Corp, but Epiphyte will still be in the dark. No doubt that's exactly how they want it. It occurs to Randy to look over at the dentist. Dr. Hubert Kepler is sitting on the same side of the table as he is,
and so it's hard to read his face, but it's clear he's not listening to John Cantrell. He's covering his mouth with one hand and staring into space. His Valkyries are furiously passing notes back and forth, like naughty cheerleaders. Kepler's just as surprised as Randy. He doesn't seem like the kind of guy who delights in surprises. What can Randy do right now to enhance shareholder value? Intrigue is not his specialty. He'll leave that to Avi. Instead, he tunes out the meeting, opens up his laptop, and begins to hack. Hacking is an overly glorious word for this. Everyone in Epiphyte Corp has a laptop with a tiny built-in video camera so that they can do long-distance video conferencing. Avi insisted on it. The camera is almost invisible. Just an orifice a couple of millimeters across, mounted in the top center of the frame that surrounds the screen. It doesn't have a lens as such. It's a camera in the oldest sense, a camera obscura. One wall contains the pinhole, and the opposite wall is a silicon retina. Randy has the source code, the original program, for the video conferencing software. It is reasonably clever in its use of bandwidth. It looks at the stream of frames, individual still images coming from the pinhole camera, and notices that, although the total amount of data in those frames is rather large, the difference from one frame to the next is tiny. It would be altogether different if frame one were a talking head and frame two, a fraction of a second later, were a postcard shot of a Hawaiian beach, and frame three a diagram of a printed circuit, and frame four a close-up of a dragonfly's head. But, in fact, each frame is a talking head, the same person's head, with minor changes in position and expression. The software can save on precious bandwidth by mathematically subtracting each new frame from the previous one, since to the computer each image is just a long number, and then transmitting only the difference. What it all means is that this software has a lot of built-in capabilities for comparing one image with another, and gauging the magnitude of the difference from one frame to the next. Randy doesn't have to write that stuff, he just has to familiarize himself with these already existing routines, learn their names and how to use them, which takes about 15 minutes of clicking around. Then he writes a little program called Mugshot that will take a snapshot from the pinhole camera every 5 seconds or so and compare it to the previous snapshot, and if the difference is large enough, save it to a file. An encrypted file with a meaningless random name. Mugshot opens no windows and produces no output of its own, so the only way you can tell it's running is by typing the Unix command, PS, and hitting the return key. Then the system will spew out a long list of running processes, and Mugshot will show up somewhere in that list. Just in case someone thinks of this, Randy gives the program a fake name, Virus Scanner. He starts it running, then checks its directory and verifies that it has just saved an image file, one mugshot of Randy. As long as he sits fairly still, it won't save any more mugshots. The pattern of light that represents Randy's face striking the far wall of the camera obscura won't change very much. In the technology world, no meeting is complete without a demo. Cantrell and Furr have developed a prototype of the electronic cache system, just to demonstrate the user interface and the built-in security features.
A year from now, instead of going to the bank and talking to a human being, you will simply launch this piece of software from anywhere in the world, Cantrell says, and communicate with the crypt.
He blushes as this word seeps through the translators and into the ears of the others.
Which is what we're calling the system that Tom Howard has been putting together.
Avi's on his feet, coolly managing the crisis.
Mi Fu,
he says, speaking directly to the Chinese guys,
is a better translation.
The Chinese guys look relieved, and a couple of them actually crack smiles when they hear Avi speaking Mandarin. Avi holds up a sheet of paper bearing the Chinese characters. The first one, Mi, meaning secret, and the second one, Fu, having a dual connotation meaning, on the one hand a symbol or mark, and on the other hand, Taoist magic. Painfully aware that he has just dodged a bullet, John Cantrell continues with a thick tongue.
We thought you might want to see the software in action.
I'm going to demo it on the screen now, and during your lunch break, you should feel free to come around and try it out yourselves.
Randy fires up the software. He's got his laptop plugged into a video jack on the underside of the table so that the Sultan's lurking media geeks can project a duplicate of what Randy's seeing onto a large projection screen at the end of the room. It is running the front end to the cache demo, but his mugshot program is still running in the background. Randy slides the computer over to John, who runs through the demo. There should be a mugshot of John Cantrell stored on the hard disk now.
I can write the best cryptographic code possible, but it's all worthless unless there is a good system for verifying the user's identity,
John begins, regaining some poise now.
How does the computer know that you are you? Passwords are too easy to guess, steal, or forget. The computer needs to know something about you that is as unique to you as your fingerprint. Basically, it has to look at some part of your body, such as the blood vessels in your retina, or the distinctive sound of your voice, and compare it against known values stored in its memory. This kind of technology is called biometrics. Epiphyte Corp. boasts one of the top biometrics experts in the world, Dr. Eberhard Fuhr, who wrote what's considered to be the best handwriting recognition system in the world.
John rushes through this encomium. Eb and everyone else in the room look bored by it. They've all seen Eb's resume.
Right now, we're going with voice recognition, but the code is entirely modular, so we could swap in some other systems, such as a hand geometry reader. That's up to the customer.
John runs the demo, and unlike most demos, it actually works and does not crash. He even tries to fake it out by recording his own voice on a pretty good portable digital tape recorder and then playing it back. But the software is not fooled. This actually makes an impression on the Chinese guys, who, up to the point, have looked like the contents of Madame Tussaud's dumpster after an exhibition on the Cultural Revolution. Not everyone is such a tough sell. Harvard Lee is a committed Cantrell supporter, and the Filipino heavyweight looks like he can hardly wait to deposit his cash reserves in the crypt.
Lunchtime! Doors are hauled open to reveal a dining room with a buffet along the far wall, redolent of curry, garlic, cayenne, and bergamot.
The dentist makes a point of sitting at the same table with Epiphyte Corp., but doesn't say very much. Just sits there with a dreadfully choleric expression on his face, staring and chewing and thinking. When Abby finally asks him what he thinks, Kepler says, levelly,
"It's been informative."
The three Graces cringe epileptically. Informative is evidently an extremely bad word in the dentist's lexicon. It means that Kepler has learned something at this meeting, which means that he did not know absolutely everything going into it, which would certainly rate as an unforgivable intelligence failure on his scale of values. There is an agonizing silence. Then Kepler says,
"But not devoid of interest."
Deep sighs of relief ventilate the blindingly white, plaque-free dentition of the hygienists. Randy tries to imagine which is worse, that Kepler suspects that the wool was pulled over his eyes, or that he sees a new opportunity here. Which is more terrible, the paranoia or the avarice of the dentist? They are about to find out. Randy, with his sappy romantic instinct for ingratiation, almost says something like, "Well, that's been informative for us, too." But he holds back, noticing that Avi has not said it. Saying it would not enhance shareholder value. Best to play one's cards close to the vest. Let Kepler wonder whether Epiphyte Corp. knew the real agenda. Randy has chosen his seat tactically so that he can look straight through the door into the conference room and keep an eye on his laptop. One by one, members of the other delegations excuse themselves, go into the room, and run the demo, imprinting their own voice into the computer's memory and then letting it recognize them. Some of the nerds even type commands on Randy's keyboard, probably that PS command, snooping. Despite the fact that Randy's got it set up so it can't be meddled with too much, it bothers him at a deep level to see the fingertips of these strangers prodding away at his keyboard. It gnaws at him all through the afternoon session, which is all about the communications links joining Kinakuta to the wide world.
Randy ought to be paying attention to this, since it impinges massively on the Philippines project. But he doesn't. He broods over his keyboard, contaminated by a foreign touch. And then he broods about the fact that he's brooding about it, which demonstrates his unfitness for biz. It's technically Epiphyte's keyboard, not even his. And if it enhances shareholder value for sinister Eastern nerds to poke around his files, he should be happy to let them do it. They adjourn. Epiphyte and the Nipponese dine together. But Randy's bored and distracted. Finally, about 9 p.m., he excuses himself and goes to his room. He's mentally composing a response to root@eruditorium.org, along the lines of, because there seems to be a hell of a market for this kind of thing, and it's better that I fill the niche than someone frankly and overly evil. But before his laptop has even had time to boot up, the dentist, clad in a white terrycloth robe and smelling like vodka and hotel soap, knocks on Randy's door and invites himself in. He invades Randy, no, the shareholder's, bathroom and helps himself to a glass of water. He stands at the shareholder's window and glowers down at the Nipponese cemetery for several minutes before speaking.
"Do you realize who those people were?" he says.
His voice, if subjected to biometric analysis, would reflect disbelief, bewilderment, maybe a trace of amusement. Or maybe he's just faking it, trying to get Randy to let down his guard. Maybe he is root@eruditorium.org.
"Yeah," Randy lies.
When Randy revealed the existence of Mugshot after the meeting, Abby gave him a commendation for deviousness, printed up the mugshots in his hotel room, and Federal expressed them to a private dick in Hong Kong. Kepler turns around and gives Randy a searching look.
"Either I had bad information about you guys," he says, "or else you are way in over your heads."
If this were the first business foray, Randy would piss his pants at this point. If it were the second, he would resign and fly back to California tomorrow. But it's the third, and so he manages to maintain composure. The light is behind him, so perhaps Kepler's momentarily dazzled and can't read his face very well. Randy takes a swallow of water and breathes deeply, asking,
"In light of today's events," he says, "what's in store for our relationship?"
"It is no longer about providing cheap long-distance service to the Philippines, if indeed it ever was in the first place,"
Kepler says darkly.
"The data flowing through the Philippines network now takes on entirely new significance. It's a superb opportunity. At the same time, we're competing against heavy hitters, those Aussies and the Singapore group. Can we compete against them, Randy?"
It is a simple and direct question, the most dangerous kind.
"We wouldn't be risking our shareholders' money if we didn't think so."
"That's a predictable answer," Kepler snorts. "Are we going to have a real conversation here, Randy, or should we invite our PR people into the room and exchange press releases, hmm?"
During an earlier business foray, Randy would have buckled at this point. Instead, he says,
"I'm not prepared to have a real conversation with you here and now. Sooner and later, we have to have one," says the dentist.
"Those wisdom teeth will have to come out someday."
"Naturally. In the meantime, here is what you should be thinking about," Kepler says, getting ready to leave. "What the hell can we offer in the way of telecommunications services that stacks up competitively against the Aussies and those Singapore boys? Because we can't beat them on price."
This being Randy's third business foray, he doesn't blurt out the answer. Redundancy.
"Well, that question will certainly be on all of our minds," Randy says instead.
"Spoken like a flack," says Kepler, his shoulders sagging.
He goes out into the hallway and turns around, saying,
"See you tomorrow at the crypt."
Then he winks.
"Or the vault, or cornucopia of infinite prosperity, or whatever the Chinese word for it is."
Having knocked Randy off balance with this startling display of humanity, he walks away.
Yamamoto.
Tojo and his claque of Imperial Army boneheads said to him, in effect, "Why don't you go out and secure the Pacific Ocean for us, because we'll need a convenient shipping lane, say, about 10,000 miles wide, in order to carry out our little plan to conquer South America, Alaska, and all of North America west of the Rockies. In the meantime, we'll finish mopping up China. Please attend to this ASAP." By then, they were running the country. They had assassinated anyone in their way, they had the Emperor's ear, and it was hard to tell them that their plan was full of shit, and that the Americans were just going to get really pissed off and annihilate them. So, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, a dutiful servant of the Emperor, put a bit of thought into the problem, sketched out a little plan, sent out one or two boats on a small jaunt halfway across the fucking planet, and blew Pearl Harbor off the map. He timed it perfectly, right after the formal declaration of war. It was not half bad. He did his job. One of his aides later crawled into his office in the nauseatingly craven posture that minions adopt when they are about to make you really, really unhappy, and told him that there had been a mix-up in the embassy in Washington and that the diplomats there had not gotten around to delivering the declaration of war until well after the American Pacific Fleet had gone to the bottom. To those army fuckheads, this is nothing. Just a typo. Happens all the time. Isoroku Yamamoto has given up on trying to make them understand that the Americans are grudge holders on a level that is inconceivable to the Nipponese, who learn to swallow their pride before they learn to swallow solid food. Even if he could get Tojo and his mob of shabby, ignorant thugs to comprehend how pissed off the Americans are, they'd laugh it off. What are they going to do about it? Throw a pie in your face like the Three Stooges? Ha ha ha! Pass the sake and bring me another comfort girl! Isoroku Yamamoto spent a lot of time playing poker with Yanks during his years in the States, smoking like a chimney to deaden the scent of their appalling aftershave. The Yanks are laughably rude and uncultured, of course. This hardly constitutes a sharp observation. Yamamoto, by contrast, attained some genuine insight as a side effect of being robbed blind by Yanks at the poker table, realizing that the big, freckled louts could be dreadfully cunning. Crude and stupid would be okay. Perfectly understandable, in fact. But crude and clever is intolerable. This is what makes those red-headed ape-men extra double super loathsome. Yamamoto is still trying to drill the notion into the heads of his partners in the big Nipponese scheme to conquer everything between Karachi and Denver. He wishes that they would get the message. A lot of the Navy men have been around the world a few times and seen it for themselves, but those Army guys have spent their careers mowing down Chinamen and raping their women, and they honestly believe that the Americans are just the same, except taller and smellier. "Come on, guys," Yamamoto keeps telling them. "The world is not just a big Nanjing." But they don't get it. If Yamamoto were running things, he'd make a rule. Each Army officer would have to take some time out from bayoneting Neolithic savages in the jungle, go out on the wide Pacific in a ship and swap 16-inch shells with an American task force for a while. Then maybe they'd understand they're in a real scrap here. This is what Yamamoto thinks about shortly before sunrise as he clambers onto his Mitsubishi G4M bomber in Rabaul, the scabbard of his sword whacking against the frame of the narrow door. The Yanks call this type of plane Betty, an effeminatizing gesture that really irks him. Then again, the Yanks name even their own planes after women and paint naked ladies on their sacred instruments of war. If they had samurai swords, Americans would probably decorate the blades with nail polish. Because the plane's a bomber, the pilot and co-pilot are crammed into a cockpit above the main tube of the fuselage. The nose of the plane, then, is a blunt dome of curving struts, like the meridians and parallels of a globe, the trapezoids between them filled with sturdy panes of glass. The plane has been parked pointing east, so the glass nose is radiant with streaky dawn, the unreal hues of chemicals igniting in a lab. In Nippon, nothing happens by accident, so he has to assume that this is a deliberate morale-building tip of the helmet to the rising sun. Making his way up to the greenhouse, he straps himself in where he can stare out the windows as this Betty
and Admiral Ogaki's take off. In one direction is Simpson's Harbor, one of the best anchorages in the Pacific, an asymmetrical U wrapped in a neat grid of streets, conspicuously blighted by a fucking British cricket oval. In the other direction, over the ridge, lies the Bismarck Sea. Somewhere down there, the corpses of a few thousand Nipponese troops lie pickled in the wrinkled hulls of their transport ships. But all of their weapons and supplies went to the bottom, so the men are just useless mouths now. It's been like this for almost a year, ever since Midway, when the Americans refused to bite on Yamamoto's carefully designed feints and ruses up Alaska way and just happened to send all of their surviving carriers directly into the path of his Midway invasion force. Shit, 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 shit! Yamamoto's chewing on a thumbnail right through his glove. Now those clumsy, reeking farmhands are sinking every transport ship that the Army sends to New Guinea. Double shit! Their observation planes are everywhere, always showing up in the right place at the right time, tally-hoeing the Emperor's furtive convoys and the sawing twang of bloody gummed Confederates. Their coast watchers infest the mountains of all those godforsaken islands, despite the Army's efforts to hunt them down and flush them out. All of their movements are known. The two planes fly southeastwards across the tip of New Ireland and enter the Solomon Sea. The Solomon Islands spread out before them, fuzzy jade humps rising from a steaming ocean 6,500 feet below. A couple of small humps and then a much bigger one. Today's destination, Bougainville. Have to show the flag, go out on these inspection tours, give the frontline troops a glimpse of glory, build morale. Yamamoto, frankly, has better things to do with his time, so he tries to pack as many of these obligatory junkets into a single day as possible. He left his naval citadel at Truk and flew to Rabaul last week so that he could supervise his latest big operation, a wave of massed air attacks on American bases from New Guinea to Guadalcanal. The air raids were purportedly successful. Kind of. The surviving pilots reported vast numbers of sinkings, whole fleets of American aircraft destroyed on their mucky airstrips. Yamamoto knows perfectly well that these reports will turn out to be wildly exaggerated. More than half of his planes never came back. The Americans and their almost equally offensive cousins, the Australians, were ready for them. But the Army and the Navy alike are full of ambitious men who will do everything they can to channel good news the Emperor's way, even if it's not exactly the truth. Accordingly, Yamamoto has received a personal telegram of congratulations from none other than the Sovereign himself. It is his duty now to fly round to his various outposts, hop out of his beddy, wave the sacred telegram in the air, and pass on the blessings of the Emperor. Yamamoto's feet hurt like hell. Like everyone else within 1,000 miles, he has a tropical disease. In his case, beriberi. It is the scourge of the Nipponese, and especially of the Navy, because they eat too much polished rice. Not enough fish and vegetables. His long nerves have been corroded by lactic acid, so his hands quiver. His failing heart can't shove fluid through his extremities, so his feet swell. He needs to change his shoes several times a day, but he doesn't have room here. He is encumbered not only by the curvature of the plane's greenhouse, but also by his sword. They are approaching the Imperial Navy Air Base at Bougainville, right on schedule at 9:35. A shadow passes overhead, and Yamamoto glances up to see the silhouette of an escort, way out of position, dangerously close to them. Who is that idiot? Then the green island and the blue ocean rotate into view as his pilot puts the Betty into a power dive. Another plane flashes overhead with a roar that cuts through the noise of the Betty's engines, and although it is nothing more than a black flash, its odd fork-tailed silhouette registers in his mind. It was a P-38 Lightning, and the last time Admiral Yamamoto checked, the Nipponese Air Force wasn't flying any of those. The voice of Admiral Ogaki comes through on the radio from the other Betty, right behind Yamamoto's, ordering Yamamoto's pilot to stay in formation. Yamamoto cannot see anything in front of them, except for the surf washing ashore on Bougainville and the wall of trees seemingly to grow higher and higher as the plane descends, the tropical canopy now actually above them. He is Navy, not an Air Force man, but even he knows that when you can't see any planes in front of you in a dogfight, you have problems. Red streaks flash past from behind, burying themselves in the steaming jungle ahead, and the Betty begins to shake violently. Then yellow light fills the corners of both of his eyes. The engines are on fire. The pilot is heading directly for the jungle now. Either the plane is out of control, or the pilot is already dead, or it is a move of atavistic desperation. Run, run into the trees! They enter the jungle in level flight, and Yamamoto is astonished how far they go before hitting anything big. Then the plane is bludgeoned wide open by mahogany trunks, like baseball bats striking a wounded sparrow, and he knows it's over. The greenhouse disintegrates around him, the meridians and parallels crumpling and rending, which isn't quite as bad as it sounds, since the body of the plane is suddenly filled with flames. As his seat tears loose from the broken dome and launches into space, he grips his sword, unwilling to disgrace himself by dropping his sacred weapon, blessed by the Emperor, even in this last instant of his life. His clothes and hair are on fire as he tumbles like a meteor through the jungle, clenching his ancestral blade. He realizes something. The Americans must have done the impossible, broken all of their codes. That explains Midway. It explains the Bismarck Sea, Hollandia, everything. It especially explains why Yamamoto, who ought to be sipping green tea and practicing calligraphy in a misty garden, is, in point of fact, on fire and hurtling through the jungle at 100 miles per hour in a chair, closely pursued by tons of flaming junk. He must get word out. The codes must all be changed. This is what he is thinking when he flies head-on into 100-foot-tall Octomalus Sumatrana. Antaeus. When Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse sets foot on the Sceptred Isle for the first time in several months at the ferry terminal in Outer Mowbray, he is startled to find allusions to springtime all over the place. The locals have installed flower boxes around the pier, and all of them are abloom with some sort of Precambrian decorative cabbage. The effect is not exactly cheerful, but it does give the place a haunted druidical look, as if Waterhouse is looking at the northwesternmost fringe of some cultural tradition from which a sharp anthropologist might infer the existence of actual trees and meadows several hundred miles farther south. For now, lichens will do. They have gotten into the spirit and turned grayish-purple and grayish-green. He and Duffel, their old companionship renewed, tussle their way over to the terminal and fight each other for a seat aboard the disconcertingly quaint two-car Manchester-bound whistle-stop. It will sit there for another couple of hours, raising steam before leaving, giving him plenty of time to take stock. He's been working on some information-theoretical problems occasioned by the Royal and U.S. Navy's recent, ever since the four-wheel Enigma was broken, propensity to litter the floor of the Atlantic with bombed and torpedoed milch cows. These fat German submarines, laden with fuel, food, and ammunition, loiter in the Atlantic Ocean, using radio rarely and staying well away from the sea lanes, and serve as covert floating supply bases so that the U-boats don't have to go all the way back to the European mainland to refuel and rearm. Sinking lots of them is great for the convoys, but must seem conspicuously improbable to the likes of a Rudolf von Heckelheber. Usually, just for the sake of form, the Allies send out a search plane beforehand to pretend to stumble upon the milch cow. But, setting aside some of their blind spots in the political realm, the Germans are bright chaps and cannot be expected to fall for that ruse forever. If we are going to keep sending their milch cows to the bottom, we need to come up with a respectable excuse for the fact that we always know exactly where they are. Waterhouse has been coming up with excuses as fast as he can, for most of the late winter and early spring, and frankly, he is tired of it. It has to be done by a mathematician if it's to be done correctly, but it's not exactly mathematics.
Thank God he had the presence of mind to copy down the crypto worksheets that he discovered in the U-boat safe, which give him something to live for. In a sense, he is wasting his time. The originals have long since gone off to Bletchley Park, where they were probably deciphered within hours. But he's not doing it for the war effort, per se, just trying to keep his mind sharp and maybe add a few leaves to the next edition of the Cryptonomicon. When he arrives at Bletchley, which is his destination of the moment, he will have to ask around and find out what those messages actually said. Usually he is above such cheating, but the messages from U-553 have him completely baffled. They were not produced on an Enigma machine, but they are at least that difficult to decrypt. He does not even know yet what kind of cipher he is dealing with. Normally, one begins by figuring out, based on certain patterns in the ciphertext, whether it is, for example, a substitution or a transposition system, and then further classifying it into, say, an aperiodic transposition cipher in which keying units of constant length encipher plaintext groups of variable length, or vice versa. Once you have classified the algorithm, you know how to go about breaking the code. Waterhouse hasn't even gotten that far. He now strongly suspects that the messages were produced using a one-time pad. If so, not even Bletchley Park will be able to break them, unless they have somehow obtained a copy of the pad. He is half hoping that they will tell him that this is the case so that he can stop ramming his head against this particular stone wall. In a way, this would raise even more questions than it would answer. The Triton four-wheel naval Enigma was supposedly considered by the Germans to be perfectly impregnable to cryptanalysis. If that was the case, then why was the skipper of U-553 employing his own private system for certain messages? The locomotive starts hissing and sputtering like the House of Lords as Intertagmians emerge from the terminal building and take their seats on the train. A gaffer comes through the car, selling yesterday's newspapers, cigarettes, candy, and Waterhouse purchases some of each. The train is just beginning to jerk forward when Waterhouse's eye falls on the lead headline of yesterday's newspaper. Yamamoto's plane shot down in Pacific. Architect of Pearl Harbor thought to be dead.
"Malaria, here I come," Waterhouse mumbles to himself.
Then, before reading any further, he sets the newspaper down and opens up his pack of cigarettes.
This is going to take a lot of cigarettes.
One day and a whole lot of tar and nicotine later, Waterhouse climbs off the train and walks out the front door of Bletchley Depot into a dazzling spring day. The flowers in front of the station are blooming. A warm southern breeze is blowing, and Waterhouse almost cannot bear to cross the road and enter some windowless hut in the belly of Bletchley Park. He does it anyway and is informed that he has no duties at the moment. After visiting a few other huts on other business, he turns north and walks 3 miles to the hamlet of Shenley Brook End and goes into the Crown Inn, where the proprietress, Mrs. Ramshaw, has, during these last 3.5 years, made a tidy business out of looking after stray, homeless Cambridge mathematicians. Dr. Alan Matheson Turing is seated at a table by a window, sprawled across 2 or 3 chairs in what looks like a very awkward pose, but which Waterhouse feels sure is eminently practical. A full pint of something reddish-brown is on the table next to him. Alan is too busy to drink it. The smoke from Alan's cigarette reveals a prism of sunlight coming through the window, centered in which is a mighty book. Alan is holding the book with one hand. The palm of his other hand is pressed against his forehead, as if he could get the data from book to brain through some kind of direct transference. His fingers curl up into the air and a cigarette projects from between them, ashes dangling perilously over his dark hair. His eyes are frozen in place, not scanning the page, and their focus point is somewhere in the remote distance.
"Designing another machine, Dr. Turing?"
The eyes finally begin to move and swivel around towards the sound of the visitor's voice.
"Lawrence,"
Alan says once, quietly, identifying the face. Then, once more warmly,
Lawrence!
He scrambles to his feet, as energetic as ever, and steps forward to shake hands.
Delighted to see you.
Good to see you, Alan, Waterhouse says.
Welcome back.
He is, as always, pleasantly surprised by Alan's keenness, the intensity and purity of his reactions to things. He is also touched by Alan's frank and sincere affection for him. Alan did not give this easily or lightly, but when he decided to make Waterhouse his friend, he did so in a way that is unfettered by either American or heterosexual concepts of manly bearing.
Did you walk the entire distance from Bletchley? Mrs. Ramshaw! Refreshment!
Heck, it's only 3 miles, Waterhouse says.
Please, come and join me,
Alan says. Then he stops, frowns, and looks at him quizzically.
How on earth did you guess I was designing another machine? Simply a guess based on prior observations?
You're a choice of reading material, Waterhouse says, and points to Alan's book, RCA Radio Tube Manual. Alan gets a wild look.
This has become my constant companion, he says. You must learn about these valves, Lawrence, or tubes, as you would call them. Your education is incomplete otherwise. I cannot believe the number of years I wasted on sprockets. God!
You're a zeta function machine?
I thought it was beautiful, Lawrence says.
So are many things that belong in a museum, Alan says.
That was 6 years ago. You had to work with the available technology, Lawrence says.
Oh, Lawrence, I'm surprised at you. If it will take 10 years to make the machine with available technology, and only 5 years to make it with a new technology, and it will only take 2 years to invent the new technology, then you can do it in 7 years by inventing the new technology first.
Touché.
This is the new technology, Alan says, holding up the RCA radio tube manual like Moses brandishing a tablet of the law.
If I had only had the presence of mind to use these, I could have built the Zeta Function machine much sooner, and others besides.
What sort of a machine are you designing now? Lawrence asks.
I've been playing chess with a fellow named Donald Mitchie, a classicist, Alan says. I am wretched at it. But man has always constructed tools to extend his powers. Why not a machine that will help me play chess?
Does Donald Mitchie get to have one, too?
He can design his own machine, Alan says indignantly.
Lawrence looks carefully around the pub. They are the only customers, and he cannot bring himself to believe that Mrs. Ramshaw is a spy.
I thought it might have something to do with,
he says, and nods in the direction of Bletchley Park.
They are building, I have helped them build, a machine called Colossus.
I thought I saw your hand in it.
It is built from old ideas. Ideas we talked about in New Jersey years ago,
Alan says. Brisk and dismissive is his tone, gloomy is his face. He is hugging the RCA radio tube manual to himself with one arm, doodling in a notebook with the other. Waterhouse thinks that really the RCA radio tube manual is like a ball and chain holding Alan back. If he would just work with pure ideas like a proper mathematician, he could go as fast as thought. As it happens, Alan has become fascinated by the incarnations of pure ideas in the physical world. The underlying math of the universe is like the light streaming in through the window. Alan is not satisfied with merely knowing that it streams in. He blows smoke into the air to make the light visible. He sits in meadows, gazing at pine cones and flowers, tracing the mathematical patterns in their structure. And he dreams about electron winds blowing over the glowing filaments and screens of radio tubes, and in their surges and eddies, capturing something of what is going on in his own brain. Turing is neither a mortal nor a god. He is Antaeus. That he bridges the mathematical and physical worlds is his strength and his weakness.
Why are you so glum? Alan says. What have you been working on?
Oh, same stuff, different context, Waterhouse says. With these 4 words, he conveys, in full, everything that he has been doing on behalf of the war effort.
Fortunately, I came upon something that is actually rather interesting.
Alan looks delighted and fascinated to hear this news, as if the world had been completely devoid of interesting things for the last 10 years or so, and Waterhouse has stumbled upon a rare find.
Tell me about it, he insists.
It's a cryptanalysis problem, Waterhouse says. Non-enigma. He goes on to tell the story about the messages from U-553.
When I got to Bletchley Park this morning, he concludes, I asked around. They said that they had been butting their heads against the problem as long as I had, without any success.
Suddenly, Alan looks disappointed and bored.
It must be a one-time pad, he says.
He looks reproachful.
It can't be.
The ciphertext is not devoid of patterns, Waterhouse says.
Ah,
replies Alan, perking up again.
I looked for patterns with the usual cryptonomicon techniques. Found nothing clear, just some traces. Finally, in complete frustration, I decided to start from a clean slate, trying to think like Alan Turing. Typically, your approach is to reduce a problem to numbers and then bring the full power of mathematical analysis to bear on it. So I began by converting the messages into numbers. Normally, this would be an arbitrary process. You convert each letter into a number, usually between 1 and 25, and then dream up some sort of arbitrary algorithm to convert this series of small numbers into one big number.
But this message was different. It used 32 characters, a power of 2, meaning that each character had a unique binary representation, 5 binary digits long.
Oh, as in Bodo code, Alan says.
Bodo code is what teletypes use. Each of the 32 characters in the teletype alphabet has a unique number assigned to it. This number can be represented as a 5-digit binary number, that is, 5 ones or zeros, or more useful, 5 holes or absences of holes across a strip of paper tape. Such numbers can also be represented as patterns of electrical voltages, which can be sent down a wire or over the radio waves and printed out at the other end. Lately, the Germans have been using encrypted Bodo code messages for communications between high-level command posts, for example, between Berlin and the various Army Group headquarters. At Bletchley Park, this category of encryption schemes is called FISH, and the Colossus machine is being built specifically to break it.
He looks guardedly interested again. So I converted each letter into a number between 1 and 32 using the Bodo code. That gave me a long series of small numbers, but I wanted some way to convert all of the numbers in the series into one large number, just to see if it would contain any interesting patterns. But this was easy as pie. If the first letter is R, and its Bodo code is 01011, and the second letter is F, and its code is 10111, then I can simply combine the two into a 10-digit binary number, 01011011. And then I can take the next letter's code and stick that onto the end and get a 15-digit number, and so on. The letters come in groups of 5. That's 25 binary digits per group. With 6 groups on each line of the page, that's 150 binary digits per line. And with 20 lines on the page, that's 3,000 binary digits. So each page of the message could be thought of not as a series of 600 letters, but as an encoded representation of a single number with a magnitude of around 2 raised to the 3,000th power, which works out to around 10 to the 900th power.
All right, Alan says. I agree that the use of 32-letter alphabet suggests a binary coding scheme, and I agree that the binary coding scheme in turn lends itself to a sort of treatment in which individual groups of 5 binary digits are mooshed together to make larger numbers, and that you could even take it to the point of mooshing together all of the data on a whole page that way to make one extremely large number. But what does that accomplish?
I don't really know, Waterhouse admits. I just have an intuition that what we are dealing with here is a new encryption scheme based upon a purely mathematical algorithm. Otherwise, there would be no point in using the 32-letter alphabet. If you think about it, Alan, 32 letters are all well and good. As a matter of fact, they are essential for a teletype scheme, because you have to have special characters like line feed and carriage return.
You're right, Alan says. It is extremely odd that they would use 32 letters in a scheme that is apparently worked out using pencil and paper.
I've been over it 1,000 times, Waterhouse says, and the only explanation I can think of is that they are converting their messages into large binary numbers and then combining them with other large binary numbers, one-time pads most likely, to produce the ciphertext.
In which case, your project is doomed, Alan says, because you can't break a one-time pad.
That is only true, Waterhouse says, if the one-time pad is truly random. If you built up that 3,000-digit number by flipping a coin 3,000 times and writing down a 1 for heads and a 0 for tails, then it would be truly random and unbreakable. But I do not think that this is the case here. Why not? You think there were patterns in their one-time pads?
Maybe, it just traces.
Then what makes you think it is other than random? Otherwise it makes no sense to develop a new scheme, Waterhouse says. Everyone in the world has been using one-time pads forever. There are established procedures for doing it. There's no reason to switch over to this new, extremely odd system right now in the middle of a war.
So what do you suppose is the rationale for this new scheme? Asks Alan,
clearly enjoying himself a great deal.
The problem with one-time pads is that you have to make 2 copies of each pad and get them to the sender and the recipient. I mean, suppose you're in Berlin and you want to send a message to someone in the Far East. This U-boat that we found had cargo on board, gold and other stuff, from Japan. Can you imagine how cumbersome this must be for the Axis?
Ah, Alan says. He gets it now. But Waterhouse finishes the explanation anyway.
Suppose that you came up with a mathematical algorithm for generating very large numbers that were random, or at least random-looking.
Pseudo-random.
Yeah. You'd have to keep the algorithm secret, of course, but if you could get it, the algorithm, that is, around the world to your intended recipient, then they could, from that day forward, do the calculation themselves and figure out the one-time pad for that particular day, or whatever.
A shadow passes over Alan's otherwise beaming countenance.
But the Germans already have Enigma machines all over the place, he says. Why should they bother to come up with a new scheme?
Maybe, Waterhouse says, maybe there are some Germans who don't want the entire German Navy to be able to decipher their messages.
Ah, Alan says. This seems to eliminate his last objection. Suddenly, he is all determination.
Show me the messages.